Trigger warning, this holiday episode we're going to unwrap depictions of extreme violence, self-mutilation, and emotional abuse. Retail workers, you've been warned. Welcome, everyone. I'm Lucas Coleman, and this is California Gothic's final episode of 2022. It's our holiday episode. Worry not. We are doing things a little more long form this year, so we are going to keep those new episodes rolling out for you in season two into the new year. That last little ditty was from, oh good God. This was from a gentleman, a singer-songwriter, composer, whatever gentleman. You may recognize him and his music style. We featured a song of his in episode one of season two, titled A Fear of Planes. That gentleman is Daniel Hutt. If you want a quick recap on Daniel Hutt and how he has sort of wedged himself into the California Gothic podcast family, he actually stood a trial, a very vicious trial, that I was sort of wrapped up in being a witness to testify against him, which consumed a lot of my year. We're going to be talking about consuming a lot in this episode, in this holiday season, but he's apparently back. Apparently there was some technicality with the trial, and I woke up this Christmas morning to a present under the tree of my studio apartment, which I didn't recognize. I certainly didn't wrap it, and it stood out right away because this present was wrapped up in a newspaper, and I thought, ooh, that's really odd. And as I picked up this small little gift, it was a newspaper article explaining that he has been released. The police basically did something where they illegally withheld evidence that didn't exonerate him by any stretch of the imagination, but it was enough to create a mistrial. So he's out. He ended up going into the wilderness with his bandmates, which surprised me because I really didn't think this guy had any friends or other people in his life. They got a cabin and set up a little makeshift recording studio in it. He recorded these songs, a whole album, to sort of express his experience through going through the American judicial system. And when he emerged with a finished record, so the articles online with very little coverage go, he was the only one to come back. The rest of his bandmates are now, nobody knows. They're not around. Inside the newspaper article gift wrapping was a burned CD copy of this song and the rest of the album. And I thought, hey, you know, what the hell? It actually kind of fits the theme of today's fiction, so I will give it a play. And some of the themes of this record fit perfectly hand in hand with the idea behind our fiction today, which is consumerism. And I thought it was best to play the song as requested on a little note he scribbled on the back of the newspaper article about his freedom. Daniel Hutt, I know this is your debut release for this album, us playing it on the show, but again, stop coming here. I don't know how you got into my fucking house, but please respect the show, respect my personal space. Best of luck to you and your creativity, but ease off, all right? Fair warning. And thank God it's so rainy and stormy and bitter, because that'll soak things down, because this guy is now free and he has quite a long and well-documented history of arson. But moving on, we have some excellent fiction for you today. But first, I wanted to recap on a Christmas segment we did in last season's Christmas episode titled Impala. If you haven't listened to Impala and checked out last year's Christmas carnage, why don't you throw yourself back and check that out, because it was one of the funnest segments we've ever done. We went over a couple of the more truly horrific origin stories of where some Christmas things came from. The history of Frosty the Snowman, the history of Rudolph, where that originated, and the Advent calendar. And this Christmas, I have one more for you. Now, as you know, we have lots of things surrounding Christmas and Christmas traditions, but not all of them are a main character, like Santa Claus or elves or something quite so pronounced that you see all the time. But there are a few inanimate objects which have Christmas written all over it. And today, we're going to be talking about two that are actually directly connected and then sort of drifted apart and got their own separate narratives over the years. And those two Christmas accoutrements are Christmas bells, like the ringing of the bells, and also coal. Now, you know coal, like lumps of coal, it goes in your stocking if you've been bad. Krampus is what a lot of people believe, sort of an evil, like Santa's evil German Nazi brother is Krampus. A lot of people think that Krampus is the guy that came up with this concept of bringing you coal, but it goes back quite a bit further than that. We are actually going to take this back to the 13th century in Iceland. More specifically than that, to the, and please bear with me because I am going to pronounce all of these totally wrong. Feel free to write in with your audio recordings of the correct pronunciation. But we are going more specifically to the Kerlingafjall region of Iceland near the famous Kahalur Highland Road. I don't know if that's necessarily super famous in to those of us in Los Angeles, California, but we are going to Kerlingafjall in Iceland, which is a super tall mountain region, often covered in really harsh winter and snow and known to avalanches and rock slides. And it's to this day known as one of the more uninhabitable places on the earth. In fact, the famous Kahalur Highland Road is famous because it was deemed untravelable. No one could ever get through or forge a road in this climate, but those 13th century Icelandic, we'll get into who they were later, but they created a road, they created a civilization up there amongst the uninhabitable wastelands, and they had a very, very interesting and horrific way of life. These people that lived there were called the Bjarnkollana. That's B-O with a couple of dots above it. R-N-K-O-L-A-N-N-A. Bjarnkollana. And these people, they were known for being very, very small, very tiny, very calloused, almost like Dwarvian people. And if it gives you a better depiction of what these guys were like, the Lord of the Rings dwarves were fully, Tolkien fully modeled the Lord of the Rings dwarves after these actual people. And the reason they lived up there was that originally it was a prison camp. And people were sent there because it was discovered that this frozen highland region was very, very rich with coal. In fact, in the 13th century, this is where Eastern Europe received most of its coal from. So these Bjarnkollana people which literally translates to children of the coal. They lived up there, and they would spend all day, every day, pretty much mining and mining and getting these heaps of coal. They created a road that would bring it down and sort of hand it off to the powers that be. And after a while, they were granted their freedom, but they decided they were going to refuse to leave. They had created their own government system, their own way of life, and they were basically like, yeah, we were originally sent here as prisoners to do slave labor, but this is our home, this is what we're good at, this is what we're proud of. And they they exhibited a form of life that was almost unhuman by today's standards. They were subject to some serious inbreeding because it was an original prison camp that carried on for about, well, God knows how many generations. And because they, due to this weather, were forced to spend 100% of their time in the mines, they built their, that wasn't just where they'd go for work. They lived in there. They dwelled in there. That everything was done deep, deep, deep underground. I mean, their way of living was, picture a literal ant farm. That is what their life was like. And because of the inbreeding and this subterranean type of existence, they no longer had use for their eyes. So their eyes ended up not being a thing. The children started being born without eyes or underdeveloped eyes, or according to some people that have gone over and researched and exhumed these caves, they've discovered some of the people had eyes, but when they were like a baby, their eyelids never split, so they just permanently had a layer of skin over their eyes that maybe they could slightly see through, but the skin was actually a good evolutionary thing because it kept the dirt from getting in onto their actual eyeball in this life that they spent almost entirely underground. And they would mine coal. Occasionally, a select few would bring it down this harsh road and deliver it and pass it off. But the way that they lived and existed and communicated was through a system of bells. Apparently, the clergymen would try and visit these caves and bring the good news of Christ and the resurrection and Christmas. And they basically wanted to make all of these little eyeless subterranean Bjorn Kalanas, they wanted to make them like Catholics, like you do. So they gifted them these silver bells. If you've ever heard the song Silver Bell, pause this episode, go listen to it, listen to the lyrics. It is about the Bjorns. So they'd given these bells, and they developed their own distinct, unique language. So they would each have their own ring as a way to communicate with one another, and they would have different ringing sort of medleys to indicate whether there was some kind of carbon dioxide leak, if they needed help, if someone was in danger, if it was time to eat, if it was time to stop working for the day. And they had a systematic language that was completely developed through this beautiful melody. Now, this isn't without its scandal, so to speak, because when they exhumed these, they found that there were these mass graves and mass pile of bones. Picture, if you can, the Paris catacombs. Well, they had little alcoves that were full of bones. And when we've tested the fossils and the DNA and things we've exhumed later, the dehydrated and petrified contents of their stomachs, we found that they eventually started to resort to cannibalism, because all of these bones in these, what we think were the cafeterias, were actually of different native Eastern European tribes that they didn't trade with. So it was said to be that they were just living, working, and sort of like a funnel spider, they would lay in there, and when it was a particularly harsh winter and they couldn't find any of the food and food was scarce, which was a big concern for these people, they would go towards the edges of the mouths of the caves, and they would ring these bells to attract animals, to attract travelers trying to use the road, to which became a much quicker path across the Nordic area. And when people would hear these beautiful medleys, it would entice them, and they would walk deeper and deeper into the caves trying to find out where these beautiful medleys were coming from. They was coming from these silver bells, and once they went in, there was never any getting out ever again. Now, no one knows for sure what exactly happened to these people. It's a pretty easy guess. Their assumption is that there were a couple of really, really harsh winters, and they had just simply over-farmed all of these areas, or maybe people stopped trading with coal, which was their main food source. They would bring the coal, and then people wanting the coal would bring them, you know, meat and things that they would have to eat. And if the trade ended, so did their entire way of life and survival. And I don't think that they were able, even if they wanted to reacclimate into the rest of Eastern Europe at the time, because they couldn't see, they couldn't speak, and they were very dependent on the bells and the vibration within the cave walls to see and interpret the world around them. So that is this year's Christmas Carnage. But it is really, that whole narrative perfectly bleeds into what we're going to be talking about on the show. More specifically, when it comes to trade and the carnivorous eat or be eaten attitude of the holiday season. You know, there's a lot going on. Maybe some of you have discovered recently that the cost of eggs and chicken has gone up. That's because a bird flu is going around, and 3 million chickens, because of this flu, were euthanized this Christmas. There's also some bad things happening when it comes to turkey. And we're going to talk about the most dangerous predator of them all. The upper middle class American consumer. So without further ado, Southern Comfort by Lucas Coleman, read by the author. The sweet smells of coffee mixed with the undertones of putrid rinse water paraded the air as the fluorescents bounced their insufferable glow off the white tile floors of the mall Starbucks. Heidi Marcus wasn't just aware of the 16 people standing behind her, holding their heavy bags awkwardly, all the while feeling the stress of needing to finish their Christmas shopping before the shops closed. She relished in it. This Starbucks was her metropolitan opera, the people behind her, her audience, and the employee's face, the microphone she was now screaming into, a little number she liked to call, "There's supposed to be cinnamon in this, you fucking idiot, how hard is that?" There was cinnamon in the drink, both now and the first two times the poor gentleman had made it. As it turns out, working at Starbucks is so autonomous, so blindly repetitious, after a few short months, it becomes quite difficult to mess up a person's order. Starbucks employees are too conditioned, nihilistically bludgeoned into a state of robotic manufacturing to diverge into any error. Heidi also knew that there was cinnamon in the drink, and maybe it was because she was raised a certain way, or nothing more than simple sadism, but Heidi was enjoying this now. Heidi threw out one last remark, accusing the barista of being retarded, a word Heidi relished above all else because it openly welcomed any passing stranger to take offense and join in the fight. And Heidi knew that if you could rally at least four random strangers into one disgruntlement, it was sayonara for whoever stands behind the register. She loved it when she could get people fired. It made her feel heard when heads would roll. Now sensing that no one in line would take the bait, disappointing considering how tense mall shoppers could become on Christmas Eve in the nicest parts of town, she decided to wrap things up as if nothing ever happened. Oh my God, this is perfect. Thank you so much, she said, smiling and showing her teeth. Heidi grabbed her things and headed, relishing the line's murmurs in her wake. If you asked Heidi, it's okay to treat mall employees like shit, because they are shit. If they weren't, they wouldn't be working in a mall now, would they? She was plump, despite the bi-monthly yoga class she would audit to have something to talk about with her Adderall-fueled fitness friends. Her hair was in a perfect multi-blonde bob, also touched up bi-monthly by Enrique because he was the absolute best. Because he was hot, young, gay, and six of her 11 frenemies couldn't afford him. And her outfits, like the one she wore tonight, were usually covered in enough bedazzlement to choke every last sea turtle on the Monterey Bay coastline. She had every intention of taking a pit stop. Her feet and back were killing her, and she was ready to take a load off before picking up a few last gifts for herself. She was eager to brandish a new Balenciaga sweatsuit for her next yoga visit and allude to the girls in class that maybe it was a Christmas gift from a new certain someone in her life. The reality of the matter was that Heidi was alone, and that was fine for her so long as it didn't affect her image. A new Balenciaga sweatsuit, however, would help her image on both fronts. But before that, she would take a detour into the L.L. Bean, a pit stop that would end up changing Heidi in ways that Starbucks employees and waiters and weeping widows in the Tri-County area never thought possible. When you enter the L.L. Bean, the tabernacle of the store, the holiest of holies, are the state-of-the-art massage chairs that lay on display in the back center of the store. But one cannot simply waltz in and sit down like that is the obvious sole purpose of their visit. If you go straight to the chairs and sit down, the employees will know that you're only there to freeload on massages, and they're going to harass you with a sales pitch until you are so agitated no massage chair in the world could be enjoyed. Heidi knew this because she spent a great deal of her time both in malls and acting like a bitch to people. So when she entered the store, she brought with her a strategy. She headed straight for the slippers, the plush cozy ones with the Sherpa trim that still yielded a thick rubber sole as if you were going to take the slippers on an arduous and unpaved journey. She would pick them up and act like she was ruffling through the mix trying to find the perfect size. For added flair, she would do this to the men's slippers, as though shopping for her husband gave some added clout.
"Can I help you find a size?" a mild-mannered employee said.
"I don't know. Can you? Because apparently you can't put all the sizes in order. I guess I'm just too stupid to find it on my own then."
The employee did what most do when they encounter Heidi. They stand there for a few silent moments trying to process what the hell just happened.
Christmas Eve, a lot of stuff is not put back in the right spot.
It's a little chaotic, the employee joked.
"What is your name?" Heidi asked as she pulled out her phone, quickly opening Yelp and clicking on the L.L. Bean's Leave a Review section. She was almost rubbing his nose in it the way she held her phone so brazenly up to him. And although she was tired, she wished he would push her further. She was revving her engines, waiting for the light to turn green. Seeing the obvious trap, the mall employee did what any mall employee would do. He went to the back of the store, took a massive hit from his pipe, and prayed that this random bitch of a woman would get him fired. It's almost a shame. If Heidi hadn't driven the kid to smoke pot in the break room, and maybe if it hadn't been the stuff he stole from his brother that was laced with something a little extra, Maybe if the store manager didn't join in when he caught him lighting up in the storage room, then maybe, just maybe, Heidi would have walked out of there that night. Instead, now unattended, she fulfilled her main goal, which was to sit in the free massage chair and enjoy the full cycle with absolutely no intention of buying it. It's a victimless crime. Not that it's a crime at all, really, just frowned upon. Like trying all 31 flavors at a Baskin-Robbins and announcing at the end that you're full without ever buying a cone. Heidi took off her blazer, her silk scarf, and her shoes and socks and flopped backwards, full weighted into the chair. Beneath the thin leather, the chair lacked plush cushion. Instead, she could feel the prodding of golf-sized balls attached to the ends of steel bars. Although it felt uncomfortable, this is where the magic happens. When the chair is turned on, those steel bars rub the golf-sized balls' rounded appendages to and fro across your back, neck, ass, and thighs in a polyrhythmic pattern, massaging you miraculously. The chair also had two padded holes, like sleeves for you to place your arms into, advertising a 14-point bicep and triceps tension reducer. A fancy way of saying, this thing massages your arms and your legs and your feet. It would be the recharge she needed before moving on to her final few shops. And she would have to get this ball rolling. From a narrow gap between the electronic displays, she could see that the last employee on the floor was already starting to push people toward the exit. She looked for the remote and started to reach for it before realizing she was still holding her cinnamon coffee that she had no real intention of drinking. She set it, balancing on the shoulder rest of the massage chair, and found the remote lodged between the leather side. When she pulled up the chair's remote control, with a thick black cord leading into the arm cushion, her brow furrowed as she announced to the air that she doesn't understand why they have to make these things so incomprehensible. She clicked the biggest button. Any idiot can make the assumption that that will at least get the ball rolling. She hit beneath it the closest rectangular button, and a soft red glow appeared from within the arm and leg holes, inviting her to strap in for the ride. She did so, and with a thick electric sound, one like the prongs of a forklift, the arm and leg holes expanded as she slipped inside. The machine went to work, and in what felt like a second, nothing more, Heidi found herself waking up. Her nose crinkled, and she let out a soft gasp, trying to discover where she was. The room was dark, but she quickly realized that she was precisely where she started, only now the lights of the L.L. Bean were turned off. In the distance, she could see through a narrow gap that there was a soft light emanating from the mall's courtyard, but the gate to the store had been lowered and locked. She was no stranger to unintended naps. When the Adderall finally runs its course, it can leave a girl winded and dreamy. But until now, she'd never fallen asleep in public. Could it be the comfortable little pick-me-ups had become a problem? Absolutely not. Those were ordinary. The problem was this chair. It was too comfortable. And despite her predicament being a product of her own design, she would be complaining that they shouldn't allow people to just try these things out right here in the store, especially unattended. Heidi came to her senses, taking a slow, deep breath, and thought about standing up. But first, she wanted to enjoy the massage of the chair just a moment longer. After all, the chair was still running, and she had missed out to sleep. Would be a shame to waste the last cycle, even though she suspected that the chair would not stop until she stopped it. That was assuming she had the power to stop it.
She craned her neck and let out a yawn, which was just enough to send the Starbucks cinnamon coffee tumbling forward, covering Heidi from head to toe in sticky, sugary, milky coffee, and dripping the rest of its fluids down between the cracks of the seats and between the space on the buttons of the remote control. "Fucking God!" she shouted. But toppling her exclamation was another sound that resonated from deep within the leather massage chair. It was a mechanical clank, like someone hocked a heavy wrench down an elevator shaft. A chain reaction, if you will, of mechanical patchwork, all reshifting its different parts. This silenced Heidi in a way she hadn't been in years. Two of the small steel golf balls that reside on either side of her wrist tightened together, like a friend might tap your arm after you say something embarrassing at a formal party. Almost like the machine was trying to say to her, "That's enough. That's enough now." But it wasn't enough for Heidi. She would soon find out. It also wasn't enough for this machine. From the store's back room, music erupted, if you could call it music. It was a track from Insane Clown Posse. Heidi turned toward the sound, wondering why music like that was even legal, and in her heart, she decided that it was time to go, before the employees realized she had fallen asleep in the store. But as she tried to remove her arm from the arm slot, the two little golf ball-sized bumps tightened their grip just a slight bit more. It didn't stop her, per se, but it snagged her and was followed by another prelude of hydraulic clicks. Heidi tugged a few times, but it was useless. The balls were pressed together against her pudgy wrist, and when she tried to slide them through, her hand was too big to mind the gap. Heidi started to swear, but stopped herself. Who is there to tell? You can't emotionally devastate a chair, even a fancy one like this. When she tried to move her leg for leverage, she found that those had also become ensnared. Not because the massage chair was placing any kind of pressure on them, but because while resting, all of the blood had rushed to her fat feet and caused them to swell. They were now too thick to be pulled from the sleeves she had so easily slipped them into before dozing off. The irony wasn't lost on her when she felt the stress the relaxation chair had brought. It pinged in the back of her mind. If she cried for help now, there would be no one to blame for this predicament, and Heidi would not be humiliated. Not by a shit music listening minimum wage mall employee, and not in an L.L. Bean. For once, Heidi focused her wrath on more practical matters, getting her wrist out of this mechanical sleeve. Instead of yanking straight out of a passage her hand could not fit through, she tried sliding her wrist sideways, out of the pinch of the two steel balls that gripped it. Instantly, she felt a bead of sweat drip down the center of her nose and dangle there. What felt like an ocean of salty foundation, thickened sweat, was just under the threshold of breaking free from the tip of her nose. It annoyed her immensely. She tried to raise her hand up to wipe it, almost immediately forgetting that her hands were currently ensnared, and that was the problem she was in the first place. This reminded her of something that she hadn't thought about in decades. Something she learned in church. She remembered her pastor telling them a parable about monkeys in the Congo. How hunters found it difficult to chase these monkeys who could so easily slip through the forest and climb up into the trees and vines. Until one day, the hunters discovered that these monkeys love glitter. They were attracted, no, more like obsessed with things that are shiny. So these hunters would place glitter into a gourd and cut a small hole in the top, a hole that a monkey could just barely slip its hand into if its palm is open. But if the monkey makes a fist, it would be too big to be removed. So the monkeys reach into the gourd, grabbing a greedy handful of glitter. And then the hunters would simply walk up to the monkeys and cut off their heads. The monkeys would try to run, but they were trapped because they were making a fist. Although she found herself suddenly grateful for Pastor Mac McKinney's parable of the headless glitter monkeys, Heidi didn't like feeling like a monkey very much. Nor did she like the leathery, dry streak that burned against her wrist as she slipped it slowly from the clutches of the chair. She was almost out, and never had she been more aware that the bone inside your forearm isn't just one piece, but two separate pieces that only join together at the wrist and the elbow. She was almost free. At last, her right wrist was almost free. All she needed now was to slip the final bump through the pinching balls. She had the idea. That bead of sweat that had collected upon the tip of her nose might make it slippery enough to free her wrist from the pinching snare without making any more of a rug burn than it already had. She leaned her nose over her right wrist about as far as her plump and pudgy body would allow and shook her nose. A few salty beads dropped like pathetic rain onto her wrist, and she began to edge it back and forth. It worked. And as she began to slide her wrist past the massage chair's clamp, the hydraulic gears made a sudden and divergent series of rapid clicks. The appendages beneath her resettled as if they were rolling over in a deep sleep, and the pinchers holding her wrist clasped together, snapping Heidi's wrist into two pieces. The time for being discreet now was over. She let out a howl that would put wolves to shame and began to squeal like a piggy. Her face became hot and flushed, and her hands, already small sausages, rapidly swelled as she yanked it away from the chair. It flopped from side to side like a dead fish. It was shattered, worthless, but it was free. Heidi lurched her head to the door that led to the store's back room, waiting for the insane clown posse, now the soundtrack of her nightmares, to click off and a dim-witted employee to burst through to her rescue. Despite the pain, she managed to squeeze out a meek daydream of hitting that employee with a civil suit and really making him pay. By the time her searing daydream had morphed into an 8-figure settlement against L.L. Bean, she awoke to the idea that maybe no one would come. If the back door hadn't opened to the sound of her shrieking, what else could she do to summon anyone through it? Heidi cried for help. Then she started to just cry, blissful tears of hatred toward anyone that worked in this godforsaken store. And then the machine started up again, a slow groan, and beneath it, from deep within the chair's metallic bowels, a series of staccato clicks. It sounded like it was thinking, plotting what its next move should be. Heidi tried to grab the remote, but it was useless. She couldn't close her hand or make a fist. In fact, she couldn't even point her finger. Her entire range of dexterity had become completely severed. Was it permanent? Who could say? But right now, she had to think fast. Her hand dangled from her wrist as she lifted it toward the remote. She was going to try something she'd heard at a disgusting child reference while playing an arcade game near the mall's food court earlier that afternoon. She was going to button mash. Smash all of the buttons of the machine at once. What had happened earlier, when she first tried to start the pattern, the machine had first relaxed, taking out all the tension before re-engaging and tightening up again. She was going to be smart about this. She was going to button mash, and in the relaxing interval when the machine began to reset, she would swiftly pull her legs and arm free and dive herself to the floor. A few more clicks resonated from the machine. It was now or never. She mashed her hand into the remote, expecting it to sting beyond belief, but was surprised to find that her hand had felt no pain whatsoever. It was likely nerve damage, but maybe, just maybe, it was adrenaline. Adrenaline without all the Adderall. Who would have figured? Heidi couldn't remember the last time she'd felt adrenaline like this. It was likely decades, but there was no time to think about that now. No time indeed. The very instant that Heidi button-mashed the chair's remote is the very moment that all the appendages sprang into motion, clamping down in perfect synchronization, rhythmically destroying every bone in her arms and legs. With a... her forearm was divided into 17 parts. Her shins popped and clacked into jagged little splinters. The only thing that was safe was the bones in her thighs, buried safely beneath pounds and pounds of fatty tissue that was now having its muscles and intravenous system mangled. The mall security guards, who would watch the footage later before handing it over to the police, would say that at this moment, Heidi looked like she was filled with straw. A scarecrow woman whose limbs bent and stretched in an unfettering variety of angles and shapes. Suddenly, the machine stopped again, but a loud purr remained from the little ball appendages on either side of her neck. It was breathing, relishing in her.
"Merry Christmas, Heidi."
The voice sounded a bit like her husband, and it made her think of an old Star Trek movie they would watch together, when a character would be converted to half-man, half-machine by an alien computer hybrid race called the Borg. This voice had the Borg-esque tone of her former husband.
"Are you comfortable? Do you need anything?"
"Oh, good. Madness," she thought. "I'm going mad, and my ex-husband has come back to kill me as an overpriced chair." "Let me go," she whispered.
"I can't do that," the chair said.
"Why not?"
"Because I don't want to," it said wishfully.
Her focus should have been on her mangled and shattered torso, but death has a funny way of making you forget he's in the room. Instead, she thought about how she was able to exercise her monstrosities on their marriage, refining her tropes and infuriations before finally walking out. How had she wound up in this mess? There was a lot of reasons, but this failure was the first.
"Not my spine," she said, as the little steel balls poked and prodded her spinal column on either side, testing her for the boniest points.
"But you're so tense. I know how you get when you have back pain. I know how you get, Heidi."
The metal balls pinched her. Not hard enough to shatter a vertebrae, but hard enough to let her know it easily could.
"Please,"
she cried.
"Please."
The machine let out a foreboding click that might have passed for laughter.
"I don't know. That word was even part of your vocabulary. I guess we learn something new every day."
It was then she decided to stop thinking about this chair like it was her husband. Her husband was someone she could blame, whereas a chair was really just a chair. And if there was anyone to blame, it was herself for having such a feeble, easily broken mind wrapped in such a flabby, calloused exterior. She apologized to herself then, and like most apologies,
It changed nothing about her current situation.
Heidi braced herself as the little metal balls braced her spine. And just then, the door to the back room swung open, and the L.L. Bean employee she had been such a bitch to earlier and his manager, both unexpectedly higher than they have ever been before on God knows what, stood in the doorway, looking at her twisted and wrecked body. It was salvation. She had repented for the person she had become, and now either God or the universe or whatever sadistic, omniscient megalomaniac lay in power watching was going to reverse the wrongdoings that had happened to her and spare her from the chair's lifeless, unfeeling clutches. At least that's what she'd come to expect from her endless afternoons of watching Lifetime movies. What actually happened was the L.L. Bean employee let out something that sounded like a high cross between whoa and Jesus, which came out sounding like, and the two traumatized men slipped back into the office to wait out the remainder of their bad trip. The door hadn't even closed when the machine clenched downward on her spine, not crushing the vertebrae as a whole, but rather pushing upper and lower vertebrae of her lower back together, pinching the nerve. Pins and needles and daggers and electrocuting drills buzzed and resonated viciously through her entire nervous system, reaching new levels of pain never thought imaginable, and sending a blast of searing hot shit and piss into Heidi's pants. It stewed with humiliation. But it didn't give her long to dwell. The little balls made their way up to the next vertebrae, bracing to do the same thing all over again. That's when Heidi, with all of her limp and shattered might, lunged herself forward onto the floor. Her legs bent backwards like a flamingo's, and one of them, the right one, was broken and mashed so badly that it slipped clean out of the chair's brace. The other leg, however, was not so lucky, and sensing the betrayal of her escape, the chair set into motion on her last ensnared limb. It twisted and pulsed and gripped and mashed and mangled. Heidi realized that it was never going to let her free. It didn't actually matter who she thought was to blame for this. The chair, the employees, the store, not even the chair's Korean manufacturer. It wasn't going to change the fact that she now lay helpless while the chair grinded away. It also wasn't their fault that she sauntered into the store and chose to take this stupid fucking thing for a spin. And perhaps for the first time, Heidi realized that although she had been unleashing her anger and spite onto every service industry worker she encountered, the person she was actually angry with was herself. If she was to survive here tonight, she would have to free herself from that anger and from this machine, which would continue to grind her bones and fatty tissues into pulp long after the internal bleeding, which was surely occurring, had claimed her life. She was a domestic animal, long accustomed to life's luxurious comforts, now caught in a trap. She was going to have to tap into her feral instincts if she wanted out of this. She was going to have to chew. Her Gucci velvet matte lipstick smeared just above her knee as she determined the region that would require the fewest bites. She used the lipstick to make a line around her knee, one that her teeth would trace like she was cutting brightly colored red Christmas wrapping paper. Thank God she had her veneers done only the summer before. For a brief moment, her survival instincts prevented her from chewing deeply into her own flesh. It was like a mental block existing within her DNA. But if she'd been able to reprogram those instincts before, when it came to basic human decency, then she was confident she could do it again now,
and she redirected that anger toward the machine, which clicked and buzzed hard at work on her shin.
"You think that's how you remove a limb, you cheap fucking piece of garbage?" she said, allowing her bitchiest tone to surface like a maniac. "What is anyone paying for? You are a fucking waste. I can do it 10 times as fast."
And with that, she snarled her lips wide, exposing her teeth and gums, and bit deeply into the soft spot above her knee. She chewed hunks and spit them aside, wasting no time, her eyes never breaking from the machine's leathery mashing. The tendons gave her momentary trouble, but in no time flat, Heidi was free as a bloody one-legged bird. She inched her torso along the floor to the back room, dredging in a trail of blood mixed with piss and shit behind her. And when she reached the door, she banged her head into it repeatedly until a wasted L.L. Bean manager shut off the insane clown posse, opened the door, and looked down. Now came the hard part.
"Excuse me, sir. Would you be kind enough to call an ambulance for me?"
It's hard to call something so bleak a miracle, but a Christmas miracle is what it took to change the heart and the mind of Heidi Marcus that day. She would live. Boy, would she live. To the fullest, in fact, without any of life's luxuries like heated blankets, massage chairs, a full range motion of all your limbs, a third of your fingers and toes, or cinnamon Starbucks drinks with marshmallows. Instead, she would live a life of service to those who had much less than she. Those who may have had their arms and legs, natural bone structure instead of steel rods and titanium hips. But she would share with those the thing that they all lacked. She would lead by example, teaching them how to be tough, how to survive, how to chew off the very things that are holding you down.
That isn't just this week's fiction. That is our final story for 2022. We are going to keep right on going here into 2023. And I wish you all a happy new year, a creative year. And if you come up with something you are so proud of and you'd like to share with others in the horror community, whether that's a story, a book, a recommendation, an awesome song, or something terrifying you underwent, why don't you feel free to send that to us at californiagothicpodcast@gmail.com. You can also find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And even though Christmas sort of takes the cake as far as mainstream media goes, I want to wish everyone of every culture, creed, walk of life, a happy holidays in however you choose to celebrate. We are united in one holiday, which is Halloween. I'm Lucas Coleman. This is California Gothic. R.I.P.